union, 'cause she's so good to me. And I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay.
Welcome back to Background Briefing. My name's Toby Miller and I'm sitting in for Ian Masters. Joining us now is Margaret Gray, a professor of political science at Adelphi University, whose teaching interests include non-citizen workers, food politics, alternative agriculture, race and ethnicity, and social movements. Her forthcoming book is entitled, and I hope I'm going to pronounce this the right way, Labour and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Margaret Gray. How are you?
Oh, thank you so much. I'm well, Toby.
And is it pronounced locavore?
It is pronounced locavore.
And for people
who consumes local foods.
Right, right. We just looked it up on Wikipedia to tell you the truth. So ignorant are producer Graham Fitzgibbon and myself. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, Margaret Gray, about this book that you've written and it's about to come out. What is the point of labor? What is the relationship between labor and locavorism?
Right. So I'm trying to make an intervention here between the food movement and farm workers. And essentially, this is a case study of Hudson Valley farm workers on the East Coast, one of the most vibrant local food regions in the country. And, you know, when we look at the food movement, popular literature, there's been so much amazing writing that has primed us to ask questions about animal welfare and ask questions about the environment. And I think there's very little out there that primes us to ask questions about labor. And again, I'm talking about labor on these smaller farms and regional agriculture, which largely we think of when we think of the local food economy. And I also think that there's a lot of romanticization that happens around small farms, and that the food movement really glorifies the small farm ethic. So when labor conditions are talked about, the fingers are pointed at corporate industrial factory farms. And I think consumers are, it's easy for consumers then to assume that labor conditions on these local farms are much, much better than those on the larger factory farms.
And I wonder if I could ask you to define the term food movement for me. I mean, food movement presumably refers to those people who are trying to be more environmentally conscious. Is that right?
Well, I think there's certainly more than one food movement, right? But there's been this trend over the past decade about alternative food and local food. And largely, when I say the food movement, I'm meaning the writers, the consumers, those who are interested in the food production and food consumption outside of the corporate industrial system. So you've got food writers like Michael Pollan and Eric Schlosser, for example, who are, you know, telling us about the ills of the corporate industrial food system and raising our awareness. And certainly we've seen an incredible increase in shoppers at farmers markets, people belonging to CSAs, which is community supported agriculture. So I guess I use this term food movement rather loosely. But I think probably most of your listeners, you know, it's hard to pick up a regional magazine or a regional newspaper and not see a lot of attention paid to local farmers and the benefits of local farming, whether it's, you know, just getting fresher seasonal vegetables or working on a more community sustainable model and keeping food dollars local.
So your concern is that the criticism and the endorsement both adopt and assume a consumerist perspective without sufficient address of work questions. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And the subtitle of my book is The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. And what I want to argue is that when you read what most food writers are writing about, there is a lot of talk about sustainability, which I will not try to define. But I think sustainability in terms of people thinking to create a food system that's going to last for a while, that is not purely focused on profit-driven motive, but that has other goals, whether it's making sure that food dollars stay local, that people might be supporting local farmers whose farms are at risk from real estate development, for example. So there's a fair amount out there, and I think when we talk about the environment, you know, this is about an ethic. It's what we believe in for the future, that we have ethical concerns about the way the environment is treated. And when we talk about animal welfare, again, I think this is about a food ethic, supporting local farmers, keeping the food dollars local. I think these are all about promoting that food ethic, and that the food movement could now embrace labor issues on these smaller farms.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your investigations in the Hudson Valley in upstate New York. Namely, explain to us, if you could, what the labor conditions are for some of the, presumably in some cases, migrant workers laboring on these farms, by contrast, say, with working for a big corporation.
Right. So I guess just to remind your listeners that I'm a scholar, not an expose writer. So there are certainly instances of extreme abuse on Hudson Valley farms, but what I've looked at more are the structural factors that create this class of workers who are really impoverished and have almost no political voice. So the place I would start would be with the labor laws. On the federal level, farm workers do not have a right to overtime protections. They don't have a right to a day of rest, and they don't have a right to collective bargaining protections. And that last one means that if workers were to form some sort of union, employers would not be required to recognize a union in agriculture. So that's the federal level legislation. California is different because of the farm worker movement under Cesar Chavez, and California has its own labor act for agriculture with overtime provisions, with collective bargaining provisions. But most states in the U.S., including New York State, do not offer these rights and protections for farm workers. So, for example, I know farm workers who work 80 to 90-hour work weeks, and they only get paid a flat minimum wage at $7.25 an hour because they're not required to be paid overtime protections. And that's not just during a few weeks at peak harvest season, but that continues for months and months.
I'm speaking with Margaret Gray, a professor of political science at Adelphi University, whose teaching interests include non-citizen workers, food politics, alternative agriculture, race and ethnicity, and social movements. Her forthcoming book is entitled Labor and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. And Margaret Gray, you're talking about the structural background, if you like, to the experience of working in the food industry in small businesses in the Hudson Valley. So for New York workers, there isn't a lot of legal protection. There aren't a lot of provisions there to give them some of the luxuries, if we can call them that, or the safety nets that have been striven for by working people over the centuries. So what is daily life like for them?
So, you know, I've met workers who are up at 6 in the morning, working out in the fields. Certainly summertime in New York, temperatures can get pretty hot, and I've spoken to workers who talk about, you know, feels like you can never drink enough water to keep satiated and hydrated, very similar to California. But the weather conditions in New York also mean that there are some workers who work year-round and working in not only the extreme heat, but extreme cold, snow, ice, rain sometimes. So the other aspect is that factory farms are largely mechanized. These are the monocrop, your tomato farm or your carrot farm. So when they're mechanized, you can often have these mechanical harvesters. But when you have farms that are small, it can be very difficult for them to afford to buy mechanization. And if you have a diverse crop, it's almost impossible because there's no one machine that can help harvest everything. So in the fruits and vegetables, which the Hudson Valley really specializes in, has this incredible diverse bounty of fruits and vegetables. This is all requires hand application for the harvesting process, for the weeding process. So you've got a lot of stoop labor happening, meaning that workers are bending all the way over to pick something like a squash off the ground. You've got a lot of bending at the knees that happens, often sharp instruments. So, you know, I think that the typical farm worker situation is not that unsimilar to farm workers on California farms. What I would point out, though, that I found with my research is even though I found that labor conditions largely mirror the labor conditions of workers on all size farms, including the industrial farms, on these smaller farms in the Hudson Valley, I found that there was this layer of paternalism that exists because the farmers have a more intimate relationship. They're usually directly managing their workforce instead of having a middleman. And the paternalism, which is very complex, serves as a form of labor control. You've got mostly undocumented farm workers, for example, who feel that the boss is an element of protection for them in their community. And so when the boss tells them, listen, try not to leave the farm that much because I'm worried about you might get pulled over by someone out there, I think there's a genuine concern on the part of the farmer for the workers, but there's also a genuine concern on the part of the farmer for making sure that he or she has a workforce. So that's just one example of paternalism that happens. But I think that this paternalism is really interesting because it acts as another layer of labor control.
And Margaret Gray, can you tell us a bit about the response to your research? In other words, what do the bosses think of it and what do the workers make of it?
So years ago, I first published a lot of the raw data from the interviews I collected back in 2002. And so many of the workers I interviewed told me, please get our word out there. We feel like we don't really have a voice in the system, and they're not really comfortable expressing their own opinions much of the time. So I often had workers sort of lean over the table and tell me, this is really important. Thank you for doing this work. Clearly, I don't think the farm industry appreciates the research I do because I'm presenting everything from the worker's point of view and making arguments for why labor laws should be expanded to include farm workers. So I think, for the most part, a lot of farmers in New York are going to see my work as really threatening their ability to make a profit because it would be all about hitting their wallet if something like an overtime protection were to be passed. But I've interviewed farmers for my book. I've interviewed about almost 20 farmers for my book. I didn't feel I had to interview that much more because there is so much data out there from the farmer's perspective. But I spoke to a lot of farmers who, they care about their workers. They wish they could pay them more. But, you know, they're not going to start paying them overtime if they don't have to pay them overtime. I think a lot of the farmers have tried to imagine, what's it going to mean for me if these sort of new protections do arrive in New York State? And in that regard, what I have to say is that I did historical research. And going back over two centuries of farming in the Hudson Valley, these poor farmers have had to deal with changing circumstances almost constantly. And so I think that they're a really savvy lot. They're a smart lot. And if the overtime protections were to kick in, that they would figure out how to alter their payment structure so it wouldn't affect their bottom line that much. So let me just give you one example. If you're a farmer and you're already paying workers $10 an hour at a flat rate, and the overtime protection kicks in, it would be pretty easy to just lower the base rate that you're paying workers to accommodate for the extra overtime and the other fees involved. And I think that the farmers who are going to be most hurt if an overtime protection did get passed in the New York State Legislature are really those who are paying workers the minimum wage or really close to the minimum wage and expecting extensive hours from them. So, you know, I don't blame farmers for not wanting to embrace my research, but I certainly have met a handful of farmers who say that, you know, they completely agree with me, they need to see the structure change, and that, yes, there are going to be farmers in New York who are hurt if the overtime protections come about.
Thanks for being with us today, Margaret Gray.
Thank you, Toby, very much.
I was speaking with Margaret Gray, a professor of political science at Adelphi University, whose teaching interests include non-citizen workers, food politics, alternative agriculture, race and ethnicity, and social movements. Her forthcoming book is entitled Labour and the Locavore, The Making of a Comprehensive Food Ethic. We'll take a break now for station identification and be right back with Ben Carrington to discuss mega sporting events and their socio-political implications and questions of race in contemporary sporting life.